I want to say good morning to all of you. I hope you've had a good week. There was an omission that I made last week, and I wanted to fix that this week. About 3 weeks ago, just before Christmas, you guys gave a very generous gift to Barbara and me, and I need to tell you again how much we appreciate that, how much we look forward to taking advantage of both sides of that gift. And if you've forgotten or don't know what the gift is, you can ask me privately, but I'll probably smile when I tell you. In any event, I do hope you've had a good week. It is special to have Wayne back. It is special to have Mary Ann back. We miss the folks that want to be here and find themselves unable to be for one reason or another. This morning, we continue our study in James. Those of you who haven't been here for a couple of weeks, we actually moved to a new book. And so we're in the book of James. If you'll find James, there's a section we're going to talk about. The part we're going to look at is in James chapter 1. We talked last week about trials and testing and how to handle those. This week we're talking about the origin of temptation. I told you we were going to do this. And so what I'd like to do is read a section that starts in verse 13 and runs through verse 21. And this is the part I want us to talk about this morning. Never, when you're being put to a test, say, God is tempting me. God cannot be tempted by evil, and he does not put anybody to the test. Everyone is put to the test by being attracted and seduced by that person's own wrong desire. Then the desire conceives and gives birth to sin, and when sin reaches full growth, it gives birth to death. Make no mistake about this, my dear brothers. All that is good, all that is perfect, is given us from above. It comes down from the Father of all life. With him there is no such thing as alteration, no shadow caused by change. By his own choice he gave birth to us, by the message of the truth, so that we should be a sort of first fruits of all his creation. Remember this, my dear brothers. Everyone should be quick to listen, but slow to speak, and slow to human anger. God's saving justice is never served by human anger, so do away with all impurities and remnants of evil. Humbly welcome the word which has been planted in you and can save your souls. We talked about the fact that this week we were going to discuss the origin of temptation. That's what I proposed for us to do. And in the process, I want to talk about temptation, I want to talk about God, and I want to talk about the remedy that God gives. So that's the order in which we're going to look at these things. All right? We're going to start off looking at verses 13, 14, and 15. And what I would like for us to do, in order to do this properly, is to ask, what was the first time of temptation or testing that you find in Scripture? Good. Where is that recorded? Good. Where in Genesis? Well done. Early is a very good answer. Okay. So I would encourage you to hold your place, find something to put in your Bible at James 1, because we're going to keep coming back there. And every once in a while, as you know, I forget to tell you when we go back there. But, you know, put a bulletin there, put something there. And then go find Genesis chapter 3. Genesis chapter 3. Somebody said one time, and I happened to overhear it, so that means I can say it. Do you know what the first invention was that's recorded in the Bible? Do you know what the first invention was that's recorded in the Bible? You know the answer? The excuse. And it's certainly not so much of a joke given the context, right? And that's what I want you to take a look at. I want you to take a look at verses 11 and 12. Now, I'm going to assume I'm going to assume that the story is familiar enough that I can go pick pieces out of it and not get you lost. But the story's not very long, so if you want to read all the way from verse 1 to verse 24 in chapter 3, that's pretty much all of chapter 3, you'll get the full story. But I want to go and look at verse 11. Who told you you were naked? God asked. Have you been eating from the tree I forbade you to eat? There's a little from that's missing there, but you're not supposed to end the sentence with a preposition. I shouldn't do this. You'll have to forgive me. There was one time when Churchill was supposed to have ended the sentence with a preposition and someone corrected him. And he turned to the woman and he said, did you hear the story about the little boy who was going to be read a bedtime story? And he looks at the story and he looks at his mother and he says, why did you bring the story that I told you I didn't want to be read to out of up for? That thing needs a from at the end of it. Who told you you were naked? God asked. Because the man and the woman have just said, in answer to God's question, where were you? They said, well, we heard you and we hid. Why did you hide? Because you're naked. Who told you you were naked? Did you eat from the tree I forbade you to eat from? I'm going to put a from in there to make it sound right. Verse 12, the man replied, it was the woman you put with me. It was the woman you put with me. She gave me some of the fruit from the tree and I ate it. The Lord God said to the woman, why did you do that? And the woman replied, the snake tempted me, and I ate. First invention of human beings is an excuse. If my sin is somebody else's fault, then it's not my fault and I can't be blamed for it. What's the lost food of the week? Last week it was that poor fat boy and his mama doing McDonald's for forcing him to overeat McDonald's food and get fat. There's something wrong. Whatever happens, it's not my fault. It's somebody else's fault. Whoever they are, they're out of pay. I heard the phrase, I think, for the first time a month ago. You may have heard it now because it's one that really sounds right. Lottery by lawsuit. Have you heard that one? Basically, you file a lawsuit, and if you win, it's the same as winning the lottery. What is James' response? God doesn't tempt you, and God doesn't tempt me. Now, let's back up a second. I don't expect much out of this, but let's see what we get. To whom was the book of James written? If you forget, go back to James. Don't lose your place in Genesis. We're going to go back there two or three times too. If you read the first verse or two of James, it says to the 12 tribes, that is, to the Jewish people. And there are some people who think that by writing to the 12 tribes, that the author is giving a little clue to the reader that somewhere in the book, there's going to be something addressed to each of those tribes. Let me follow that thought just a little further. I don't know if I believe this yet. I haven't read it far enough. But if you go way back, you'll find Jacob blessing his children. And when he blesses his children, he says, this is what's going to happen to this. And he has things to say about each one, the nature of those children. And there are people who think that when you read through the book of James, there's something addressed to the problems that Reuben's noted for in Jacob's blessing. Because Jacob sometimes has some fairly critical things to say about the problems each one was going to run into. Issachar, this is what's going to happen to him. You look through the book of James, they line up some of those things. But it was written to Jewish people, right? It was written to Jewish people. What was Jewish thought on the source of temptation? Turns out it was very simple. God created everything. Temptation exists, therefore, God must have created it. Therefore, temptation comes from God. Now, so far, so good. But what conclusion does one reach? If it's God that's doing the tempting, then what? Not my fault. It's his fault. If he hadn't tempted me, I wouldn't have done it. And what had happened was the rabbis who worked through this were being very, very thoughtful. And they were not willing to ascribe any creative activity to any one other than God. So the question arises, if God didn't create temptation, where did temptation come from? What did God create that opened the door to temptation? Close. Jamie says people. He created choice. He created choice. We are told that some animals don't have choice. I think my dog did have choice when he soiled that chair that day. I think he knew what he had done was wrong because he hung his head and slunk into the other room when he saw me watching. But, nevertheless, we seem to pride ourselves in thinking that human beings are the ones that have choice. But God created people, at least people, with the ability to choose. And once you create choice, you create the possibility of choosing well and choosing not well. Did God create temptation? Now, this is a slick semantic point in the minds of some people, and I do not mean it to be. I mean it to say, if you start saying, because God is responsible for creation, and because I sin within that creation, therefore, it must be God's fault that I sin. If you walk that path, you're going to get in very big trouble. And so James is saying, let's just cut that out right now. The temptations are not coming from God. They're coming from you. And they're coming from things that are alive inside of you. Those things are alive inside of you because you have choices. And because your fathers and mothers had choices. And because your grandfathers and grandmothers had choices as far back as you go. Don't look at God and think that's the source of temptation. So that's sort of point one. Can you blame it on Satan? That's what Eve did, right? Do you guys know Flip Wilson? I don't think you're old enough. Do you all remember Flip Wilson? There's this wonderful moment where, dressed up like Geraldine, I think it was, he said he had this dress on, and he says, boy, this dress looks good. And then he says, Satan, get thee behind me. And Satan says, looks good from back here, too. Is that a cop-out? Can you say, it's all Satan's fault? Does Satan have a role? Yeah. Yeah. Is Satan to blame? No. Or at least if we start thinking Satan's to blame, we put ourselves in a position where we're not recognizing where the true problem is, and therefore we're not ready to let God's Spirit begin to work in us to address that problem. Doing okay so far? God does not tempt me. I am tempted. The temptation doesn't come from God. God does not tempt you. You're tempted, but the temptations don't come from God. So where do they come from? What does James say? This is time now to flip this way. We're about, 30, 40 pages in on this end. We're about 30, 40 pages in on that end. Just get flipped. What's the words that James uses here? Uh-huh. What does he say about those desires? This is verse 14, last couple of words. What does your translation say? End of 14, that's 15. End of 14. Enticement. What's the three words before that? Evil. Dragged away by your. I want to hear the words. Evil. Wait, how does enticement fit into that? He who is dragged away and enticed. Okay. If he talks about evil desires, what does that imply? There might be wholesome desires. Does God put wholesome desires inside of us? Appetites, one might call them. Appetite goes over here, gluttony goes over there. It's a continuum, right? Yours says dragged away. Mine says attracted and seduced. Dragged away has a pretty image to it. What's yours say?
Lured.
Lured. Yeah. If you're going fishing and you toss the lure out for the fish, what do you toss out? A cork? Why not? The cork doesn't attract the fish. What do you toss out? Something that attracts the fish. Satan might throw a little bait fish out in front of you. Uh-huh. Sometimes. We're going to talk about that just a minute. Okay? What tempts us is our, he says in my translation, wrong desire. Yours says evil desire, I think. Okay? Now, I got a job for you. Have you lost Genesis yet? You still got Genesis? Okay? I want you to hold your place in Genesis, mark your place in James, and go about four books past James and find 1 John. What I'm about to do is not perfect, but it's pretty good. So let's see how it works. I want to start in 1 John chapter 2, verse 15. My focus is chapter 2, verse 16, but I want to start in verse 15. So read along with me. John is speaking to us, and he says, "Do not love the world or what is in the world. If anyone does love the world, the love of the Father finds no place in him. Because everything there is in the world, one, disordered bodily desires." What does yours say?
Cravings.
Cravings. Cravings. Okay. Now, mine uses the word disordered. Okay. We could say dysfunctional. Okay? There probably are other words we could say. Obsessions. Although I think cravings is maybe somewhat softer and therefore somewhat maybe perfectly more general. Obsessions really carry it. Number two, disordered desires of the eyes. What is this? Lust. So here's number one, cravings. Two, lust. Anybody else on that one? Number three, pride in possession. What is yours? Boasting. Boasting. Pride. Okay? I have heard somebody say, pleasure, possessions, power, pride. In the sense that pride says I deserve it, pride says I ought to go get it, and I shouldn't apologize for getting it, and I shouldn't worry about anything happening to anybody else while I get it. Are there positive and good ways of thinking about these things? Of course. That's why I like my translation's word, disorder. Something's gotten screwed up there. Okay? Cravings, lusts, and I'm going to go for the word pride on that one. Okay, hold that thought. Hold that thought of those three. Go back to Genesis for just a second. That's why you need a bulletin. See, you slide a little something in there. Put that extra piece of... Yeah. If you got those little calendars they were sending around, you could use that. I saw somebody over there using that calendar. You find Genesis chapter 3? The snake was the most subtle of all the wild animals that the Lord God had made, and he asked the woman, "Did God really say you were not to eat any of the trees in the garden?" And the woman answered the snake, "We may eat of the fruit of the trees in the garden, but of the fruit of the tree in the middle of the garden, God said, you must not eat it nor touch it under pain of death." And the snake said to the woman, no, you won't die. God knows, in fact, the day you eat it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like gods, knowing good from evil. The woman saw that the tree was good to eat. The woman saw that the tree was pleasing to the eye. The woman saw that the tree was enticing for the wisdom it could give. The woman saw. Do you see a connection between what we just read in 1 John 2 and this? What do you see? Good to eat, pleasing to the eye, enticing for the wisdom it could give. Same list. That's the same list. Where do temptations come from? They come from disordered desires. Yes, ma'am.
What comes to mind to me is that it does seem that when you look at that symptom, I think that's how we all work. It's what we put. We say, well, this little lie doesn't make a difference, or it's not that good, and that's not much.
And there's the problem.
It's a slippery slope, and then like the desire to see the bread, and then it's the sin, and then it's the death.
What are we going to talk about this morning? We're going to talk first about, I say you've forgotten already. We're going to talk first about temptation. We're second going to talk about God. And third, we're going to talk about God's remedy for temptation. That's three things there. You are dead right. If you just put enough emphasis on the word look, you say it doesn't look that bad. But the heart of everything here, the heart of everything, is mistrusting God. Did God really say? No. God said this? No. That's not right. God's keeping something back from you. He's telling you something not so, so you won't realize what is so. Now, since that's in part two, we're not going to go any further with it yet. We're going to stay here for another minute or two, then we'll come back and do this. But the heart of temptation is to mistrust God. God said, this is a problem. And I look at this and say, well, it doesn't look that bad. Yes, ma'am. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I had somebody send me an email the other day that says, is to look just as bad as to do. Now, since it took me about four pages to respond to that, I won't try to do all that today. No, that's the heart of it. It doesn't look that bad at first glance. And that's where the problem comes. If you knew that there was a vicious beast that was going to consume and devour you, if you took one more step in that direction, you wouldn't take one more step in that direction. I wouldn't take one more step in that direction. But I'm constantly taking one more step in directions where it doesn't look like it's that bad. Well, we're gonna work on that. Okay. Everybody sort of see that connection? You walk through the Bible, you walk through your own heart and life, and when you look at why people sin, why I sin, why you sin, this pretty well ties it up. It's a lusting or a craving or a wanting to boast about pleasure, possessions. All tied up in pride. And of all the things that God hates, the Bible says he hates pride. At number one on the list. Somebody was about to say something.
I was just going to say that along the way, rationalizing that when people are going to die, and this is all of one thing, and
I'm just informing. You're also not old enough, I hope, to remember Hee Haw. Remember that wonderful line in Hee Haw? I would never repeat gossip, so listen first. Listen close the first time. You remember that line? You remember that line? Right? I'm back in James. Are you back in James? You can get there, right? I don't know. Why don't you let it go and you have some practice getting it back? No, you got to go back to Genesis for a minute or two. Although, since we've already talked about a little of that, we won't talk as long. James said something really interesting in the way he progresses from verse 14 to verse 15. My translation says, everyone is put to the test by being attracted and seduced by that person's own wrong desires. Dragged away, I think you said, one translation says that. Then the desire conceives and gives birth to sin, and when sin is full grown, reaches full growth, it gives birth to death. Now, somebody real smart made 3 points. Since I can read, I'll make 3 points. Point one, sin would be helpless in the absence of evil desires. Unfortunately, we live in a world the way we are. Those are there. That's a backdrop given. Point two, evil desires can be stifled or encouraged. Evil desires can be stifled or nourished. They can be controlled or given control. Evil desires can be stifled or nourished. They can be controlled or given control. What does it mean to indulge evil thoughts? Evil desires. This is the way I heard somebody put it. You allow your thoughts to follow certain directions. You allow your steps to take you to certain places. You allow your eyes to linger on certain things. You allow your mind to entertain certain possibilities. Listen to that list again. You allow your thoughts to follow certain directions. You allow your steps take you to certain places. You allow your eyes to linger on certain things. You allow your mind to entertain certain possibilities. This is not desire. This is disorder. I want to make sure you understand that. This is disordered desire. It gives rise to sin. What's sin? The desires put into action. Now, Jesus said, if a man looks on a woman to lust after, he's already sinned with her in her heart, and we're aware of Jimmy Carter having made some famous statements in some unlikely places about that. Where is the sin? I'm not drawing a sharp line here, but I am drawing a line. Somewhere back here, indulging that leads to action. The indulging begins the sin. And that's why James says, when sin is full grown, what does that mean? When you've indulged, when the actions have started, when the actions have continued, when the guilt you feel when you first put those things into action begins to get number and number. You guys know Roland Pugh? He comes to the second hour sometimes. He was pretty terribly injured a little while back. You know how he was injured? My recollection is sunburn, is that right? On his feet. You know why he got sunburned on his feet? because he can't feel his feet. He's got a disease process going on where his nerve endings don't give signals back. He can cut himself and never know he cut himself. He can have something pinch him or prick him. He never knows it. Why? Because the nerves have atrophied. They don't respond anymore. Something like that is what he's talking about. Let it get involved. Start to act on it. The guilt comes in because that's the signal the Spirit's still alive in you. If you ignore the Spirit long enough, all of a sudden you don't hear those things anymore. It doesn't bother you as much. I saw a terrible movie not too long ago where a woman was counseling a young woman who was feeling terrible guilt and pain. And she said to the young woman, "Don't feel the pain once. Then it goes away. It's not a problem anymore." Vicious advice. Vicious advice. It's probably not true. You don't feel the pain once. You feel a terrible pain. But it's not as bad. When sin is full grown means when you've let it take control. The word I heard was, when it's full grown and monstrously strong, then it, and the word that James uses is the word spawns. It's actually translated birth in most of yours. Gives birth to death. Right? But the word is spawns. Where do we use the word spawn? That's what animals and fish do when they breed. James is saying, so the commentators say, that you come to the point where your actions and responses are something less than human, or animalistic, and not animalistic like cute kittens and cute puppies, but brutish, harsh, unfeeling. We had an opportunity to see a lion last summer in Kenya, about as far as from me to Paige. The lion was drinking out of a water hole. We came in with a four-wheel drive jeep, four-wheel drive vehicle that dropped its front on the slopes down into that thing. And so we're sitting like this, and there's the lion. The lion didn't stop drinking. You can still see his tongue, but he's not looking at the water. He's looking at us. I heard somebody say one time, shark's eyes are cold. I haven't seen sharks up close, but I saw one lion. He could have come right over and taken care of me. It wouldn't have bothered him a bit. Just would have interrupted this day with a little different. Spawn is the word. That's pretty grim, right? So let's go to the second part. What's the first part? Nature of temptation. What's the second part? Let's look at God for a minute. Now, I'm back in James. Are you back in James? I see a few of you are. Okay? My translation starts out in verse 16. Make no mistake about this. Other translations say, do not be deceived. What, does yours say something different from those two? Do not be deceived. Don't be misled. Yeah. What does that imply? This is the place where it's pretty easy to be misled. This is a place where it's possible to be deceived. This is a place where it's possible to make a monstrous and terrible consequences mistake. Make no mistake about this, my dear brothers. Everything that's good, everything that's perfect, is given to us from above. It comes down from the Father of all light. With him there is no such thing as alteration, no shadow caused by change. It is a central feature of temptation to replace trust of God with mistrust of God. Now, you don't have to go back to Genesis. We have already said it. Do you remember that little line that the snake used? Did God really say this? And the woman tried to say what God said, but she missed it. She actually said more than God said. A lot of times, people who try to do good put a hedge around problem area. You know, don't do this, don't even do that. So she went further. And the snake's response was, no. Not only is that wrong, there's something that is true, the snake says, that God doesn't want you to know about. essence of temptation is to mistrust God. James is trying to address that. He says two things. God gives, and what God gives is good. Remember when Jesus said, if a child asks a father for bread, would the father give the child a snake? If he asked him for, I think it was an egg, would he give him a scorpion? Your Father in heaven gives you gifts. That's all James is saying, but it's a big one. What God gives is good, and God gives. There's nothing that comes from God that is not good. And my translation adds the word perfect, so let's review that. This is a nice excuse. What does the word perfect almost always mean when it's used in Scripture? It does not mean without flaw. It means complete or perfectly fit for some use or task. The things that God gives us are the things we need to have our lives be right in His eyes. They are complete, we have the things we need, and they are fit for the things they should be used for. Now, what happens to us when sin comes in? We begin to use things for things they weren't supposed to be used for. Now, there's a second piece that he says. First thing he says is God gives, and what he gives is good. The second thing he says is God is unchanging. This was true of God years ago. This is true of God now. This will be true of God as far as the future goes. And the picture he uses is from astronomy. The picture is something like this. If you stand and watch, you will see light and dark. You will see bright and you will see shadow, because the lights are constantly changing. But the Father of those lights does not change. That phrase, the Father of lights, says everything changes in His creation, but the one who created does not change. Now, he makes a third point. What was his first point? God gives, and what he gives is good. What's the second point? God does not change. Okay? Now, the third point is this. God has a purpose for what he gives. So let's look at the last little phrase here. This is verse 18 in James 1. By his own choice, by God's own choice, He gave birth to us. Now look at the contrast. When evil desires, disordered desires, dysfunctional desires give birth, they give birth to sin. And when sin gives birth, it spawns death. God, by His own choice, gave birth to us. And it says, by the message of truth, but that's not a very good translation. What does yours say there? By the word of truth. By the word of truth. God's purpose doesn't change either. He chose to save us. The birth he's talking about you might call the rebirth. And he uses the word of truth to do it. Take a look at John chapter 1. Take a look at John chapter 1. Nope. John. Nope. John. Gospel John, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and don't lose James. I've got 34 minutes of work left to do, and I got 7 minutes left to do it in. In the beginning was the Word, John 1:1 says. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through Him all things came into being. Not one thing came into being except through Him. What has come into being in Him was life. Life that was the light of men, and light shines in the darkness, and darkness could not overpower it. Verse 9, the Word was the real light, the true light, that gives light to everyone. He was coming into the world. He was in the world that had come into being through Him, and the world did not recognize Him. He came to His own, and His own people did not accept Him. But to those who did accept Him, He gave power to become children of God. To those who believed in His name, who were born not from human stock, or of human desire, or of human will, but from God Himself. Did you hear James? God gave birth to us. The Word became flesh, John 1:14, and lived among us, and we saw His glory, the glory that He has from His Father as the only Son of the Father, full of grace and full of truth. In all the chances and changes of a constantly changing world, God's good gifts never change. They are always good, and God's purpose remains unchanging, to turn death into life in our hearts and to help us realize we are His. You see that phrase at the end that says He wants us to be the first fruits of His creation? What are first fruits? First fruits are the things given by the worshiper to the one who is worshipped. They belong to the one who is worshipped. God says, I want you to be my first fruits. We belong to God, but so many of us act as if we don't know that. How many of you are lucky enough that you've already attended worship this morning? What was the subject? I'm a child of the King. I have a Father. What kind of Father do I have? I have a Father who loves me, who wants to be related to me, a Father who wants to give good things to me. Remember those things this morning? It's right here. What was part three? Part one was the nature of temptation. Part two, nature of God. What was part three? God's remedy for temptation. We got 35 minutes of work left to do. We got 5 minutes left. Let's see how we do. I'm back in James. Are you back in James? If you don't have a bookmark, get one. If you got four, you're probably better off. Look at the bristling bookmarks that Marion has over there. See, she's ready for bear. Verse 19. James chapter 1, remember this, my dear brothers, everyone should be quick to listen, but slow to speak and slow to human anger. God's saving justice is never served by human anger, so do away with all impurities and remnants of evil. Humbly welcome the word which has been planted in you and can save your souls. Proverbs talks over and over again, I've got some verses if you want them, I'll give them to you later, about the fact that listening is usually better than talking. There was a wonderful phrase in Barclay that talked about a guy who knew so many languages, he could be silent in 7 different languages. Isn't that a great line? Isn't that a great line? I can be silent in close to 15. But that's not the same thing. Being silent in a language means I can listen to what people say in that language. Is our effort extended and expended in trying to get God to hear what we say, or is it extended and extended in trying to hear what God has to say to us? Do we listen more and talk less, or do we talk more and listen less? Just to make sure nobody feels any worse than I do, I want to make sure that you know what my mother reports happened to me on the first day of school. I don't remember this. She says I came home from school, and that she asked me, how did it go? And I said, she said, it was terrible. Everywhere I sat, the other children would talk to me, and the teacher would have to move me someplace else. I've suffered from this one for years. I'm a teacher. And one of the commentators talked about this. Teachers are going to be a whole lot more successful with encouragement than with exasperation. Preachers are going to be a whole lot more effective with love and concern than with dislike and contempt. Parents are going to be a whole lot more effective with children. Much more likely the child is going to hear and be directed if they function with love than if they function out of anger. Does anybody remember what happened with Isaiah? You might not. But there's this wonderful section in Isaiah 5 where Isaiah is a full-grown prophet, or so it appears. and he has the finger of wrath pointed at his people, saying, woe to those, woe to those, woe to those, woe to those, and six times that phrase comes out. Then Isaiah 6 starts out, and all of a sudden, he's carried up to heaven, and he has a vision of God's throne, and he shouts out, woe is me. And I'm convinced that is when he became useful. When he realized every problem that he was talking about out there was a problem here too. Now, let's see where this goes. My translation says in verse 21, do away with. Your translations, at least one of them, says strip off. Get rid of. Now, get rid of what? Filthiness is what one translation says. Mine says impurity. That's not quite as good. Filthiness. Moral filth. Okay. Now, let me tell you, the Greek word that's used there is real close, I'm told, to the word for earwax. Think about that. Have you known of someone who had trouble hearing and went to the doctor? I can remember the phone call from Barbara's mother. You won't believe what they pulled out of there. That's the grossest stuff I've ever seen. Now, there's a second word here. Mine says remnants of evil. Yours says something a little different, I think. The word that's used there refers to tangled underbrush. You can think of a trail through the woods. They haven't been used for a while, and the undergrowth is all tangled. Or, for us, it can refer to cancerous growth. One has to be cut away. One has to be put away. One has to be cut away. One has to be put away. Cleaned up, cleared out. In order for what? Humbly welcome the word which has been planted in you, my translation says. Okay? I have an assignment. I want this half of the room to look up 2 Kings chapter 19, verse 30. You guys can look up either of these you want. I want you guys to look up 2 Kings chapter 19, verse 30. I want you all to look up Isaiah. That's the big book, just a little bit past Psalms. Isaiah 37, verse 31. You guys look up one or the other. I don't care which one. 2 Kings 19, 30. You guys look up Isaiah 37, 31. Okay? Chapter 19 of 2 Kings, verse 30. I figure I'm pretty slow at finding this stuff. If I can find both of these, we'll probably be ready. Okay? Now, what I would like is I'd like somebody on this side, Lois, you're a good reader, would you read your verse, and you guys over here, tell me what happens as she's reading this.
Once more, a remnant of the house of Judah will take root below and bear fruit above.
What's your stuff? Same thing. Root below, fruit above. In my opinion, this is the most beautiful picture of the way Christian life ought to be. You try producing fruit without roots, it's not going to work. You try having roots without fruit, it's worthless. The book of James spends more time on the second of those. How can you claim to have roots when there's no fruit? I'll show you my fruit. How could it have been there if there hadn't been roots? And then you try to figure out how you can show me you have roots when you don't have any fruit to show. And we haven't gotten into those parts yet. But that's what's here. Because when you take a look at James, are you back at James? Okay. When you look at James, he says this wonderful thing. Humbly welcome the word. Now, that is capitalized, which means we're still talking about Jesus and the Spirit of Jesus Christ alive in our hearts. Well, you can take a pen and capitalize it right now if you want to. Humbly welcome the word which has been planted in you. Let it take root, let it grow, and fill you. Because it can save your souls. Now, you don't have time to go there, but I'm going to tell you about it. Luke chapter 11, verse 24. Don't go there. Well, okay, if you feel like it, you can listen while I talk. Luke chapter 11, 24 tells about a person who has an evil spirit living within her, and the evil spirit is driven out. And it wanders across a wasted land for a long time. Then it goes back, finds the place it was, swept out and empty, and goes and gets seven spirits worse than it is, and they came in and set up house. And so the woman is worse off than she was at first. You do not get rid of evil by getting rid of evil. You get rid of evil by filling your life with God's goodness, with God's spirit. There's a verse that says, you want to have peace, think about these things. Fill your time, fill your thoughts with good things. There won't be room for other things. That's what take root and grow is talking about. What's God's remedy for temptation? To have good things already there. So the temptations don't have an effect. Because they don't have room to grow. You're nourishing good things. You don't have effort to nourish bad things. And the good things are there. The temptations lose their attractiveness. There's a song that we used to sing when we were in college. The end of that song starts out, turn your eyes upon Jesus. Look full in his wonderful face. And the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace. That's talking about exactly the same thing. God's remedy for temptation is not the fighting of temptation. It's the filling of your heart and the filling of your day with good things. But there's just not room for this. Let's have a word of prayer. Our Father, in our hearts, we know that you are good. And we know that you give us good things. But we also know temptations come. Come to live inside of us in such presence that you fill our hearts and fill our lives to the point where there's not room for the things that shouldn't be there. Teach us how to live out your remedy for the sin problem that every one of us faces. For we ask this in your son's name. Amen. Y'all have a good day.